Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola. I'm joined by Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hello, Kevin.
And we're very pleased to have with us Brian Becker, who is the National Director of the Answer Coalition. He's also the host of Breakthrough News' Socialist Program and a first-time guest on this show somehow. I'm not sure how that happened since we're in the same circles, but welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks so much.
And we're having you on because there's this anti-war demonstration that you've organized. We want to discuss anti-war activism on March 18th. It's also the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, which is something that has been formidable in shaping the politics and our understanding of foreign policy and empire. I think, Ron, you would agree with that as well. And so... let's see. I think a good place to begin, because we'll also probably get into the war in Ukraine just a bit. Why don't we go backwards? Because oftentimes this discussion that we have about anti-war activism and organizing becomes an afterthought to the issues, to the discussion of the wars, which makes sense. I mean, that's the reason why people are mobilizing in the first place. But given how crucial it was for people to be out in the streets when President George W. Bush was plotting the war, when when his people were in the Bush administration, who came from like the Project for New American Century and everything else, were plotting to invade Iraq, and they were selling us these lies to get people to buy into the war. It was such a huge moment for the anti-war left to be able to mobilize not just thousands upon thousands of people in the streets of the United States, but around the world globally. And it really meant a lot to see all those individuals. And then you contrast that with today and the state of the anti-war movement. It feels like this might be a good place to begin a longer discussion about where we are when it comes to the anti-war movement.
Yeah, very important. Thank you so much for that sort of context and background. The Answer Coalition, which I'm the national director of, was formed on September 14th, 2001. We were in New York City. I lived not too far from the World Trade Center. We saw the World Trade Center fall down. We had friends inside. We were part of an anti-globalization movement that split apart at that point. And one wing of that anti-globalization movement decided to refocus and become an anti-war movement. And Answer Coalition was the combination of organizations from that movement who decided to make that turn on September 14th. And 18 days later, in spite of the terrible political climate in the country, I mean, Bush's approval rating was at that moment about 90%. The country was filled with rage and hysteria and grief and anger, and everybody knew a war was coming somewhere, probably Afghanistan, but beyond. 18 days later, we had a demonstration of 25,000 people in Washington, D.C., and the slogan was, "War is not the answer." It's kind of a vague slogan, like, not the answer to what? I mean, it's deliberately vague, but it was the best we could do. It wasn't like down with imperialism, which you could not do at that moment, given the political climate, even though imperialism was, in fact, at the core of the whole crisis. So that gave a lot of confidence to people that maybe something could be done to start to go back into the street against Bush in spite of the terrible political climate. And over the next year, we had demonstration after demonstration on April 20th, 2002, a few weeks after the Israelis reinvaded the West Bank and the terrible massacre in Jenin took place. At the end of March or early April, we organized a demonstration of 100,000 people for Palestine. It was the first time that there was a big action for Palestine in the United States. As a matter of fact, half of our coalition, not the Answer Coalition, but the other half of other groups, split away and created a second demonstration a few blocks away because they said you couldn't make Palestine the focus and have a big action that, you know, the political sort of demonization of the Palestinians was so complete and had been so complete that the left shouldn't deal with it. We did deal with it. And we had 100,000 people and they had about 15,000. And suddenly, you know, people could start to talk about Palestine. This was like a very momentous year. And then in September of 2002, I was at the Capitol building. We were meeting with Barbara Lee and Dennis Kucinich, and all of these liberal Congress people were running in and saying the calls coming to all members of the House and Senate were running like 300-1 against an invasion of Iraq, which now people by September 2002, Andrew Card, you know, Bush's chief of staff, said, basically, you don't advertise a new product in August. You wait till after Labor Day. Well, they were advertising that they were going to go to war in Iraq. That was the new product. And we called a demonstration at that time in September 2002. Some parts of the peace movement said, let's rely on Congress. Congress is getting all of this opposition to a war. They'll stop it. And we were like, Congress won't stop it. Congress is going to give in. They're going to cave in. They always cave in. The Congress is an imperial platform as well. And we called a demonstration for October 26, 2002, and 200,000 people came out. And that's what ignited this global movement. It was that day, October 26, 2002. And by February 15th, 30 million people demonstrated on February 15th, 2003, 1 month before the Iraq invasion. The New York Times had an editorial called "The Second Global Superpower Has Emerged," meaning the anti-war movement that turned out to be hyperbolic, but that's the way it felt at the time. And then the war came starting March 19th, 20 years ago, this March 18th, 19th weekend. And in 3 weeks, the government in Iraq was destroyed. Saddam fled, and suddenly Bush was back in the saddle. Well, he was back on the top of an aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier, which they towed out from San Diego Harbor just for a photo op so he could put on his bomber jacket and stand under a banner that said mission accomplished. And then it looked like the anti-war movement was here today, gone tomorrow. It started to dissipate. It had dissipated. But as the Iraqi resistance began and more American soldiers started getting killed, the anti-war movement revived. So by 2005, September, we had 350,000 back in the streets. So my point, Kevin, is this. When American soldiers are about to be killed, when the bleeding and suffering isn't simply with the target, but with American troops, the American people generate these very large anti-war movements. That happened in Vietnam. It happened in Iraq, and then it happened again in Iraq when the resistance grew in Iraq. So what the Pentagon is trying to do now, and what we see happening, say, in Ukraine, is, or we could see in Libya or in Syria, don't send U.S. troops on the ground. Use proxy soldiers. Have the bleeding and suffering and dying somewhere else. Tell the American people, just keep shopping. You're good. And use sanctions and drone strikes and targeted assassinations and these kind of tactics to keep the American people out of politics. And this is both a limitation on the power of the empire that it can't send its own soldiers to fight, because U.S. public opinion, even in a latent way, is anti-war. But it's also an exercise in, you know, cynical manipulation where new tools, new technologies are being employed to wage war, imperialist war, like the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, but using other people's sons and daughters to do all the dying and bleeding. So that's what we're up against when we're launching this new anti-war movement. It's not that the movement doesn't exist in the sense that we don't have popular support. It's just the drama and the mobilization is smaller when it's not Americans being sent into battle. And that's why the Pentagon got rid of the draft after Vietnam. And that's why they're trying to use these other technologies to avoid war. I think it's really important for those of us on the left to have a keen appreciation that this is both a limitation in the power of the empire, but also an expression of strength in the power of the empire, that it can actually go to war using proxies and other technologies.
Thanks for watching the Unauthorized Disclosure Weekly podcast. Please consider becoming a subscriber of our show. Go to thedissenter.org, sign up for $4 a month, and get early access to all our full episodes, as well as exclusive episodes that we post. We're in our 10th season, and we depend on people like you to keep producing conversations and interviews like this one. Thanks again, and now back to this week's episode.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, especially when you look at the difference in size that we've seen in the rallies that are happening in Europe against the war, which are growing. I mean, I think there was like in Berlin, there was like 50,000 people, if I'm not mistaken, which is a lot of people. I mean, I don't remember the last time 50,000 people came out in any American city to protest a war. And for a lot of the reasons that you're saying, and I think it's because in Europe, it's people are so much more directly affected, both geographically and economically. And the U.S. is so isolated from the consequences of the war in Ukraine, because again, it's a proxy war. And it speaks to so many of the, I think, problems, which I've talked to you about before, just as like, you know, to plug, I did have Brian on Dispatches a few months ago, where we went through the history of the anti-war left, both like decades and decades ago, and also, you know, after the war on terror, and the sort of, you know, obstacles that have existed in protesting war since the Iraq war. But we can maybe even get into a little bit of that stuff. But I wanted to ask you, since we are coming up with the 20th anniversary of the Iraq war, it's a pretty significant, you know, it's two decades, right? Since probably one of the biggest crimes, if not the biggest crime of this century so far. And I'm just curious what your reflections are as we approach this anniversary, especially, you know, since there's this march next week that's going to take place specifically geared around the anniversary of Iraq.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Well, you know, I want to approach this issue as an organizer and activist. I mean, I've been doing this literally for a half a century. I was a teenager during Vietnam. I was drafted in Vietnam. I've been organizing for a long time. So I've had a lot of experience in terms of going through the different stages, the ups and downs, zigs and zags of the movement. So I want to approach the question both as an organizer, but I'm also, you know, a Marxist. And so I'm working within like a political frame that I think also gives us a certain sort of historical understanding, not simply the understanding of activism. And I think the big takeaway from what happened with the Iraq war is that the U.S. went to war again and was defeated again. You know, the U.S. was defeated in Vietnam, right? The U.S. had to leave in 1973, and by 1975, the National Liberation Front, North Vietnamese Army, completely unified Vietnam. The U.S. lost in Iraq. The U.S. wanted to create an Iraqi puppet government. That really hasn't happened. I mean, it's fragmented Iraq. It succeeded in causing a lot of human suffering. But I'm just looking at Iran and Saudi Arabia have just signed this kind of diplomatic normalization of relations hosted by the Chinese foreign minister. After earlier talks where Iraq was an interlocutor between Saudi Arabia and Iran, that's not a puppet government. So the U.S. was defeated in Afghanistan. And again, by the way, the Afghans, the Taliban offered, they sent through a third party an offer to surrender in November 2001 in exchange for amnesty, to which Donald Rumsfeld said, F you, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And 20 years later, the Taliban are the government. I mean, surely
wild.
The extreme hubris and arrogance where the U.S. would not even accept their surrender. And yet they can't defeat the Taliban. So they can't win in Vietnam. They can't win in Iraq. They can't win in Vietnam. They didn't really win in Korea. They were driven down below the 38th parallel in Korea. So the U.S. is not winning the wars, but none of the governments who take the country into these criminal enterprises are ever held to account. None of them are impeached. None of them go to jail. The extreme power of American imperialism kind of gives an immunity to whoever the leader is. So such that Obama came in riding the wave of anti-war sentiment and said, well, we have to look forward, not backwards. I mean, he wasn't going to even prosecute them for engaging in torture, which is clearly a violation of U.S. and international law. Widespread torture by the American CIA, and nobody's going to be held to account. So when you don't hold leaders to account ever, the same things keep happening. So you have like Biden or Obama or Trump or whoever, any of them, if they're confronted with two options in the face of the enduring nonstop war lobby in America. You can try to sound reasonable, in which case you'll be accused of being weak, or you can go ahead with plans based on hubris and arrogance. And even if you lose, nothing's going to happen to you. So these opportunist politicians always make the choice to go hard line rather than become like a voice for restraint or caution or prudence or, God forbid, peace, because you'll get roasted in the American political environment. So we have a pressure cooker here. My point is, when you look at the calculus of American politics, of this empire's politics, we know with certainty that we're heading for another war. At any moment you look back in U.S. history, you can say, when is the next war going to happen?
Yeah.
It's endless war. So what's going to happen now? What's going to happen? It's, well, in 2011, Obama said, look, we're losing the wars in the Middle East and South Asia. Let's pivot to Asia because China is growing strong. The Communist Party is not going to be overthrown there. We have to compete with them. And within 7 years, the U.S. completely shifts. Nobody knew what pivot to peace, a pivot to Asia meant in 2011 when Obama said it. But by 2018, the Pentagon comes out with this quadrennial report and says, look, we have a new doctrine. The war on terrorism is passe. That's old school. That's done. We don't talk about that now. There's a new doctrine. And the new doctrine is we're going to prepare for major power conflict. So here the U.S. lost in Korea, lost in Vietnam, lost in Iraq, lost in Afghanistan. So the conclusions drawn by American policymakers is, yeah, now let's have a war with Russia and China. Like, that makes a lot of sense. You can't beat the Taliban, but you're going to fight against the People's Liberation Army in China. But this is like when you look the big historical process here, Iraq is, bottom line, a lesson unlearned. Afghanistan, a lesson unlearned. Vietnam, a lesson unlearned, meaning by policymakers. And so they're just going to go forward, accelerate, and step on the gas for the next war. That's where we're headed. And that's why the anti-war movement right now in the United States is coming back, and it is crucial. And it's going to be on March 18th, it'll be substantial. We'll have thousands of people there. I don't think it'll be tens of thousands. I know it won't. But it'll be substantial. And it's going to be a left-wing, anti-imperialist, anti-racist, pro-worker, pro-immigrant demonstration because there are forces on the political right, like Tucker Carlson or, some Marjorie Taylor Greene, like these far-right politicians who are echoing a phenomenon that took place in the before World War II, where American isolationism became a thing, led by Charles Lindbergh and Nazi sympathizers, right wingers who were against the U.S. going to war in Europe, and Norman Thomas and some of the other socialists and pacifists were kind of there more or less as window dressing, but it was essentially a right wing Republican led isolationist anti-war movement. And so that will start to happen. I think this will grow. I think that current in American politics will grow, especially if Biden is the president. If a Republican becomes the president, then it'll die down. But as long as Biden is the president or a Democrat, it'll grow. We need an anti-war movement that's based on international solidarity, progressive values, and really being pro-working class and pro-young people. So what we're doing on March 18th is super important because there is going to be another war. This is not hyperbole on our part. They're not spending $1 trillion a year. That's what the real number will be, to negotiate with people. They're spending all this money to fight. And so a new war will come soon.
Before I go with my question, Ronnie, did you want to pull on what Brian just said there?
Well, yeah, actually I did. And I want to be very careful how I thread this because I know some people get really sensitive. But I do think it's really important that you mentioned that there's a specific left-wing element to this march that's happening on March 18th, a march on March 18th. That's funny. The rally on March 18th, that it's going to be a left-wing rally. And you mentioned a few other things like anti-racist and all these sorts of things. And I do see this broader conversation, maybe conversations putting it politely, but I do see this broader maybe controversy taking place right now around the issue of like, who should we organize and who shouldn't we? And I think this has always been an ongoing question, right? Because there are times when it is conducive to perhaps, and you as an organizer can tell me what you think about this, but in certain circumstances, it can be useful to make alliances with the right on certain specific issues. I'm thinking here, like, you know, I remember during the height of the drone wars, you had like Rand Paul in Congress, who's a libertarian, who's a right winger, being against the drone wars and wanting more government oversight and all these sorts of things. And there was an ability to come together with someone like him and maybe like back a bill to add, you know, more oversight over these issues or to end certain, you know, wars. And even, I mean, I could even use a more recent example. Last week, you had Matt Gaetz, the right wing, the Republican politician, put forth this bill to, not last week, a few days ago, to remove U.S. troops from Syria, where they're occupying a very oil-rich and wheat-rich area and denying access to the Syrian government to its own resources. And, you know, it wasn't the most organized thing that Matt Gaetz did. However, I did see that the Congressional Progressive Caucus ultimately ended up backing that bill and also voting with him to do that. They didn't win, but it was actually quite close. So I think in circumstances like that, it certainly makes sense to be willing to collaborate on very specific policy goals. However, there's also this argument that we should be reaching out to the right and that we should be actually organizing rallies with the right. And so my views on this are that, like, I don't understand, like, in some cases, I do think there needs to be red lines. Like, when it comes to actual racists, should we be organizing with racists because they might be anti-NATO? I don't think that sounds like a great idea. Furthermore, I actually think that in the cases of some people on the right, the sort of Marjorie Taylor Greene MAGA people, like, they might be against the proxy war in Ukraine, but a lot of that has to do because they think we should be at war with China. So, like, how useful is it to be on the streets with people like that who already don't like you because you're left wing? If we're like Tucker Carlson types, right? How useful is that to do if ultimately they're just trying to gain, like, or to try to garner support for a bigger war that we definitely don't agree with, which is a war on China? So I don't know. I don't know what your thoughts on that. I mean, one last thing I'll say about that from my end is I also hear this argument that we need to be appealing to the right because there's so much anti-war sentiment on the right. I don't know how true that actually is, that there's anti-war sentiment on the right. However, I do know that a lot of people who say that we should do that also in conjunction will completely be dismissive and write off liberals. And all I can think about is, well, there was a time in my life when I was a liberal and I was moved to the left. And I actually agree with liberals and progressives on a lot more things than I agree with right wingers on. So it, to me, it makes more sense to be like wanting to move people who are already closer to you than to be spending all this time trying to reach out to the right. And it almost sounds like centrist Democrat ideas of wanting to always appeal to the right. To me, that's what that sounds like. Is, I mean, do I want to appeal to everybody? Yes. Do I want to change everybody's mind? Yes. But strategically, am I going to be able to change the minds of racists who like hate immigrants? I don't think so. Anyways, what are your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a pattern in the U.S. politics where the liberals are constantly trying to work with the right wing. I mean, even Biden, when he came in, he was like, let's work together. I mean, it's this whole bipartisan thing that it's a form of both bourgeois liberalism and petty bourgeois liberalism to try to always sort of move to the right, look to the right. And if you're going to make an alliance with, not, I'm not talking about conservative people like who happen to be conservative or happen to vote for Trump or happen to vote for Republicans. I mean, my extended family, which is a working class family, a number of them were going to vote for Bernie and they ended up voting for Trump. Yeah. And, they come from like industrial cities and they're basically poor people. So they've bounced around. Like when I talk to them, I don't say, oh, you voted for Trump and thus I'm not going to talk to you. I want to talk to them. I want to influence them. I want to win them over. But I want to win them over. I want to like argue about why the policies of racism are so critically important for the working class in the United States, how the campaign against immigrants has weakened unions and promoted racism and made big parts of the working class enthralled with people who are really their natural enemies, you know, like the right-wing politicians. Mm-hmm. I want to argue with them and show, you know, them that these are the same politicians who are taking away the rights of your daughters to have a safe abortion. You know, the only thing that's being illegalized is safe abortion. They can't really make abortion illegal. They can make safe abortions illegal. And like, shouldn't you and your daughter, you know, shouldn't they have those options? Like, I want to talk to people and recruit them away from right-wing demagogy.
Yeah.
But so that's one element. Then there's another element. If the liberal, and I think some of these groups that we're talking about are not really left, they're really kind of liberals of different varieties. If they say, let's unite with Tucker Carlson and the right-wing political parties, you can't do that and at the same time get up on the podium and say, look, we absolutely stand with the immigrant communities, that we disagree with those who say we shouldn't be sending arms to Ukraine, we should be sending them to the Texas-Mexican border. We disagree with that because our real enemy is on Wall Street in the capitalist boardrooms, not immigrant workers. That in fact, the workers' struggle should have no borders. That when we think of Mexicans, we shouldn't think of them as them. We should think of them as us, that the Mexicans, the Hondurans, the Salvadorans, the Nicaraguans, people in Africa, people in the Caribbean, we're part of the human family. And that we as workers are an exploited class, that we promote the idea of unity. You can't do that and share the platform with the right-wing racists who are anti-immigrant because they won't come to the demo. What happens is the liberals, when they unite with right-wingers, actually have to tailor their message so that it's acceptable to the right wing. It's not the other way around. It's not like, If we have a demonstration and let's say we have 100,000 people and we have a consistently left anti-imperialist pro-working class program and some right-wing politician says, some Republican politician says, I want to speak because I agree with you, then they're in a situation where they're basically supporting our program because they're coming to our activity. And I think that's fine. Like, why should we think a Democratic politician is so much better than a conservative politician if they're both coming to speak at a demonstration organized by the left? They're not going to, it's them actually being compelled by politics to support our campaign. But the thing that's happened, the thing that we have to avoid, and there can be very legitimate differences of opinion about this, but from my point of view, by uniting with the ultra-right and with racists like Tucker Carlson in particular, it sends a message to the Black and the Latino community by the progressive anti-imperialist movement. We favor an alliance with people who are demonizing you, stereotyping you, whipping up hatred against you, supporting your repression than we do with you. And the reality is progressive change in the United States, if one takes an objective look at American history, what's the cause of progressive change in the United States in the 19th century, in the 20th century, and even in the last two decades? It's really been the struggle of Black America more than any other community, which has functioned as a catalyst and as a detonator for other movements. So you had the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s that very much helped create an anti-war movement. It certainly created a women's movement. The women's liberation movement was an outgrowth of the civil rights Black liberation struggle. And then the movement for gay, what at that time was called gay rights, and then lesbian and gay rights, and then lesbian, gay, bi, and trans rights, or LGBTQ rights. All of those movements, profound social movements that really altered the thinking in America, where gay couples can same-sex couples can marry each other legally, which would have been unthinkable 40 years ago. That's a consequence of these very big mass movements that came out of the Black civil rights struggle, the Black freedom struggle. So if we're going to build a progressive movement that can really overcome war, it means to overcome the system. It's not just having a demonstration. A demonstration won't stop the war. Even if you have 50,000 conservatives and 50,000 liberals, that's not going to stop the war. To really stop the war drive, we need a new system. How do you get to the new system? How do you get to the new society? What are the social forces that really lend themselves to genuine social change and progress? You have to think about Black America, Latino America, the Asian American community, and the indigenous population, and overall working class and young people. And the right wing has nothing for them. So we want, we're not just fighting to have a protest on Ukraine. We want a new system. And that means having an independent political movement that can make all sorts of temporary blocks and alliances, but it needs to have a clear political message and a clear political direction in order to bring together the social forces that really have the possibility of creating radical transformative change in America.
So I want to move to the press, because I don't think we can discuss the legacy of the Iraq War and also appropriately confront the dilemmas and the situation that we find ourselves without recognizing the role that the media plays in our warfare state. And so I have this, I did this little supercut. This is 20 years ago. I want to play this. This is George W. Bush, and he held a scripted press conference. He actually says it's a scripted press conference. And this took place, I think it was like March. Let's see, I have the date here. It was on March 6th. And so I'm gonna put this tab up here, and I'm gonna play this, and then I'll ask you a question after I play this.
You'll be there in a minute. This is a scripted.
Thank you, Mr. President. How would you answer your critics who say that they think this is somehow personal? As Senator Kennedy put it tonight, your fixation with Saddam Hussein is making the world a more dangerous place. And as you prepare the American people for the possibility of military conflict, could you share with us any of the scenarios your advisors have shared with you about worst case scenarios in terms of the potential cost of American lives, the potential cost to the American economy, and the potential risks of retaliatory terrorist strikes here at home?
Let me see if I can further define what you just called this important moment we're in, since you've made it clear just now that you don't think Saddam has disarmed.
Jim Angle.
Sir, if you haven't already made the choice to go to war, can you tell us what you're waiting to hear or see before you do make that decision?
Terry Moran.
Thank you, sir. May I follow up on Jim Angle's question?
Is success contingent upon capturing or killing Saddam Hussein in your mind?
We will be changing the regime of Iraq for the good of the Iraqi people. Bill.
Thank you, Mr. President. Even though our military can certainly prevail without a northern front, isn't Turkey making it at least slightly more challenging for us?
April. Did you have a question, or did I call upon you cold?
I have a question.
Okay. I'm sure you do have a question.
Mr. President, as the nation is at odds over war, with many organizations like the Congressional Black Caucus pushing for continued diplomacy through the UN, how is your faith guiding you? And what should you tell America, well, what should America do collectively as you instructed before 9/11? Should it be pray? Because you're saying, let's continue the war on terror. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that question.
The hell was that question? What? Should America pray?
But so that was representative of the press during that time. And also, I was reading about this particular press conference and how there were journalists who were present there in the press corps who confessed that they were timid. They were afraid. They were put on primetime television. They didn't want to appear that they were weak or going limp as the Bush administration hyped these threats, which you have to remember, there were all kinds of stories they told us about what was going to happen. And, you know, I want to get into something that is unfolding right now in the press related to Ukraine. But before I do that, I'd like to get your response, Brian, to the nature of the media and how little has changed. I mean, you recognize those people in the clip who are in those the White House press corps at the time. They've all been promoted, much like we talk about Bush administration officials who got away with their crimes and never had any accountability. You know, if you were there in that correspondent position and you bought the lies You know, many of those people have been able to go on to host programs and have very high ranking positions or elite positions at these media organizations today.
Indeed. You know, Michael Gordon, who along with Judith Miller sold the war after Andrew Card came out and said, you sell a new product after Labor Day, not during August. And there was a lot of skepticism. Michael Gordon and Judith Miller started pumping out stuff in the New York Times, the paper of record, about how Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. And that's from which the Bush administration said the next terror attack, like September 11th, might be a mushroom cloud, meaning Saddam, Iraq, nuclear weapons, etc. Michael Gordon had an article this week, front page, New York Times, and the title is, the U.S. is not yet ready for major power conflict. And it's a beginning of a series in the Wall Street Journal. Now, everybody knows he lied. Everybody knows he and Judith Miller lied. People wrote books about this. But there he is, 20 years later, on the anniversary, writing front page articles like, we're not ready yet for the Iraq war. Like, we weren't ready yet for, I mean, the war with China and Russia, like we weren't ready for the Iraq war. So a lot of the same characters. I want to also say anecdotally that, you know, I started going to Iraq and bringing medicine to Iraq as an act of, along with others, as an act of international civil disobedience and the sanctions starting in May 1998. And I went to Iraq multiple times during those next 4 or 5 years, right up until right soon before the invasion. And I was also, I was on Fox News a lot. I was also on MSNBC. I was on CNN. I was kind of regular on network news shows. And as a matter of fact, in February or January 2003, MSNBC, which I had been going on a lot, called and said, would you like an exclusive, would you be willing to sign an exclusive contract with MSNBC to be a commentator on MSNBC? And this was the same producer who had been bringing me on to, you know, shows almost every week. And I was like, I don't know if I want to be a commentator, but I'll get back to you. During that same next, I would say 1 week to 2 week period, all of the newsrooms on the network news got transformed. And the floors of the studios became like the map of Iraq. And this whole new crop of commentators were hired who were retired colonels, admirals, generals. And there was a book written about this as well, about how this was actually a Pentagon operation with the media.
Yep.
That's when Phil Donahue lost his show. He was popular and also anti-war. So there was this purging. There was about 8 or 9 of us who were like sort of regular voices on cable network news who were actually left-wing anti-war people, or in the case of Phil Donahue, liberal left-wing, but anti-war. And we were gone. Now, from that time on, Kevin, we're basically off of network news. The last time I was on Fox was 2006 during the Lebanon War. And they were begging me to come on. They kept saying, come on, come on. And I was like, no, you're just going to, this is going to be a complete trashing. And then they were like, no, it's not. We're going to really let you talk. So 3 years later, I was let back on Fox News. And the way I was introduced is, the next guest is Brian Becker, who supports the terrorist organization Hezbollah in Lebanon. Brian, welcome to the show. And then I was like, Hezbollah is not a, they said, is Hezbollah a terrorist organization? And I said, no, it's not. And they said, it's not. And I was like, you're just a voice for the Israeli propaganda, war propaganda. And they shut my mic off. And that was it. They said, oh, Brian Becker left the studio. This actually happened. The screen went dark and they acted like I had fled or something. So we had this was a transformative moment, the first Iraq war, because cable network news was relatively new and there was more opening for other voices. It wasn't like as big a business as it became. But Iraq was the transformative moment when those news networks, cable news networks, 24-hour news, they became really the propaganda machine of the Pentagon. And then the Pentagon also, as it had started to do, was embedding reporters with frontline troops. So the U.S., having learned the lesson of Vietnam, which is that the American people could really become a powerful weapon against war, if they if the media told any parts of the truth, they decided to have it be a blanket propaganda effort where there is no truth. And so that's what happened in the right around the time of the run-up to the Iraq war. And that's what we live with today. That's why your show or Breakthrough News or Dispatches with Rania or other alternative media are so important, because this was a transformative moment where the capitalist media became 100% enlisted as the information war arm of the war machine. And we haven't stopped.
And, you know, and like, obviously, you know, you have been organizing around the issue of war. That's how, that makes it sound like you're pro-war. You've been organizing anti-war. You've been organizing around wars for a long time, Brian.
I'm for wars of national liberation, by the way.
Actually, that's a good point. Yeah, this is not a pacifist station here, you guys. But no, I note that to say, would you say that, like, this was a unique moment having seen the media play out during the Vietnam War? I mean, was it worse than even the first Gulf War, or was there a similarity there? Like, was this really the first time, maybe not the first time, but the most aggressive sort of consolidation of pro-war hysteria in the media that you had ever witnessed, or had that happened before?
No, it happened before, but it was very, I think it was transformative. I think it consolidated this process. Remember, in the first Gulf War, which started January 16th, 1991, and ended February 28th, it was basically a bombing war. The U.S. troops only came in the last day. So all the bleeding was really Iraqis. They just destroyed Baghdad and Basra and Mosul and so on, and destroyed the electric grid and the water system and the sanitation system, all these things that, you know, you need to live in modern society. So that was like, that was sort of, the anti-war movement didn't fully materialize. We were having demonstrations right up to the beginning of the war of hundreds of thousands of people. But because there was no consolidation of, you know, like not consolidation, but a U.S. military invasion where lots of Americans died, the U.S. kind of got away with it. But this, if at the very, this was my point, at the very end of the war, George H.W. Bush, who was president at the time, came to the microphone, and his first words when they were announcing victory after 6 weeks of war was, "The Vietnam syndrome is dead," meaning the opposition of the American people to foreign wars in third world countries. They kind of got away with it. And so then the advantage that they had at that time was Iraq actually had invaded Kuwait. So they could make the argument that this was basically a police action. It was designed to help Kuwait evict a foreign country that had occupied its soldiers, occupied its territory. But the next Iraq war in 2003, nobody thought that. Everybody thought this was a war of choice, that this was going to be a war of aggression against the country just because it was basically helpless. And that's why we were getting millions of people out literally into the streets ahead of the war, even before the war. And I think the government panicked in January 2003. We had 500,000 people on the Mall on January 18, 2003. There's never been a demonstration against war before a war starts of a half a million people. That's what we had January 18th. And then February 15th, as I said, 35 million people globally came out. So it really looked like, as the New York Times had said, a new global power, superpower, this massive grassroots anti-war movement was shaking the foundations of the war makers. So I think they made a clear decision. We have to stop this. And the only way we can stop it is to grab hold of all of the media and twist it and make it 100% blanket coverage, no anti-war voices, and make it, because it's 24/7 news, which was something basically new, that they could promote the war nonstop. And you could see that by March 15th, 1 month, 5 days before the invasion, or 4 days before the invasion, our demonstration went from millions to 100,000 on March 15th, 2003. That was 4 days. So you could see the media, the concentration of media messaging was having an impact on public opinion. And I think the lesson taken by the establishment is that this is the key to not having the Vietnam syndrome ever come back, which was make sure the media 24/7, not just three channels like Vietnam, ABC, CBS, and NBC, but hundreds of channels are all saying the very, very same thing. And that's what has happened with media. What I want to say, if we're starting to get to the finish line here about the Ukraine war and the media presentation and going back to Iraq, Saddam Hussein ordered the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in August 2nd, 1990. 7 or 8 days before that, he met with the U.S. ambassador, April Gillespie. He brought her into the presidential palace. She was the U.S. ambassador. And he basically said, what's the U.S. government position on the conflict that's going on? Because there was an enduring 18-month-long conflict between Iraq and Kuwait over a number of issues, which we don't need to talk about. And what's your view about this conflict? And April Gillespie said, I've talked to the State Department, and I'm telling you formally, officially, we, the U.S. government, don't have any position on inter-Arab disputes. Mm. On disputes. Mm. So that was the message Saddam got from the United States.
Thumbs up. Basically a thumbs up. Go ahead.
And Saddam had been functioning as a U.S. ally. The U.S. had providing arms and intelligence during the entire Iran-Iraq war, which the U.S. had also urged. So Saddam really thinks at that point, he's basically in the U.S. camp. He basically thinks the U.S. is an ally, but we're just checking. And then the U.S. says, whatever, you're the man, you do it. You got a dispute, we don't care. It's between you and Kuwait. The next week, Iraq invades Kuwait. And immediately, Saddam thinks there was an Arab League summit scheduled in Cairo for 3 days later. And Saddam figured, okay, the Arab League is going to meet. We'll have a negotiated settlement. Our grievances with Kuwait will be dealt with, blah, blah, blah. Iraq's position will be strengthened. And at that point, the U.S. comes in and says, no negotiations. We won't negotiate. The U.S. sends top officials to the Saudi royal family. The Saudi royal family then refuses to accept the idea that there could be negotiations at the Arab League. And within days, the U.S. starts sending 100,000 troops to Iraq. It was obvious that the U.S. wanted this war with Iraq. The Soviet Union was collapsing. The U.S. position then was, we're going to have a unipolar world. We're going to be able to take care of and dominate this resource-rich, oil-rich region. We're going to take out all the governments that are independent, that, you know, owe their existence to the anti-colonial project. This is the beginning. Now, when you look at what happened, as you said, Kevin, the run-up before the war in Ukraine, before Russia invades on February 24th, U.S. officials were saying very blandly, very sanguinely, oh, yeah, Russia's going to invade. Yeah, Russia's going to invade. We think Russia's going to invade. Russia's definitely going to invade. And Biden comes to a meeting with his senior officials. He said, are they going to really invade? The New York Times wrote about this. And they say, yeah, he's going to invade. And during this entire time period, there's no sense of alarm. There's no sense, let's get back to the negotiating table. Russia has red lines. Russia made it clear since 2008 that they were never going to let Ukraine come into NATO and allow advanced weapons to be put in Ukraine that target Russia. None of that. It was kind of like, yeah, they're going to invade. They're going to invade. No, their demands are non-starters. We're not going to negotiate. In fact, at that same time, the U.S. signed a military agreement with the Ukrainian government to send more weapons. That was in December 2021. That, like Iraq, the U.S. wanted this, the first Iraq war, the U.S. wanted this conflict because the U.S. thinks over time, Russia will weaken. Russia will be strategically weakened. They thought Russia would be even weaker. They thought the economic sanctions on Russia would basically evict Russia from the world economy. That hasn't really fully happened. But the U.S. wanted the conflict, and the Chinese, who didn't want the conflict, also have come now to the conclusion that if the U.S. succeeds in Ukraine, if they win in Ukraine, if they defeat Russia in Ukraine, that it's going to accelerate the war in Taiwan, the war against China. So even though I think the Chinese were not happy about Russia's action in Ukraine, Ukraine was part of the Belt and Road Initiative, after all. Even though they weren't happy, they have come to the conclusion now that the U.S. war drive, just like it was before the Iraq War, or just the way it was in 1990 with that first Gulf War, this is an unstoppable war drive, and all we can do now is prepare. And that's what's happening. China just increased its military budget by 7.2% for the next year. China believes a war is coming. They believe it's going to be fought in the East and South China Sea. The U.S. is betting that China won't escalate because The U.S. has overwhelming nuclear primacy, but it's coming, and the Chinese are preparing. And that's why I would say, in conclusion, people of the United States have to kind of parse all of this, dissect this, have a historical view, be activists, be organizers, but think critically. Look at the geostrategic context in the way the war drive has unfolded over three decades, and come to the conclusion that whenever the U.S. is selling the war, as Andrew Card said in September 2002, whenever they're selling the war, they're selling it to us. They're trying to convince us. They're trying to propagandize us so that we don't stand up, we don't organize, we don't fight back. And that's precisely what we should do.
Yeah, indeed. And here we are all this time later. And Kevin, I think you're
muted. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming on the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. We've got up on screen some of the graphics that are going around to promote the rally on March 18th. Just for people listening, it's just say no to endless U.S. wars, fund people's needs, not the war machine. And it's a protest on the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. There's a couple others that bring in some more issues. Such as the climate catastrophes that are looming, the way that the military is one of the biggest polluters, and things of that nature, that the need to close these U.S. military bases. A lot of different aspects to what you are putting together here with this coalition for March 18th. But I say that to help you plug in. Brian, if there's anything else you want to say for where people can find your work or follow you, go ahead right now.
Yeah, sure. For the March 18th, go to answercoalition.org. There's going to be a veterans contingent. That's going to be Iraq, Afghanistan, and some older Vietnam veterans all marching together to say no to war. There's going to be an artists and cultural workers contingent. As you said, Kevin, the Pentagon is the biggest polluter. There's going to be an environmental contingent. You can come to March 18th at the White House, get there around noon. Those contingents can be joined. So answercoalition.org to learn about the demo or how to get there if you're coming from a faraway place. People are bringing buses and car caravans. And also, if you want to subscribe to my podcast, it's The Socialist Program. You can find us on Twitter and other social media. We provide content 3 times a week. Socialist Program. Thanks so much to both of you. I love your show. I'm glad you finally invited me.
He's been waiting all this time. Brian's just been like, when?
Well, just so we know, Kevin has done, and of course, Ronnie, you and I talk all the time, but I don't talk to Kevin that much. But Kevin's work in as an alternative independent journalist has been superb. And, yeah, you know, I've had a chance to interview Kevin many times, and I really just want to salute both of you and your independent journalism, which is what we need.
Well, yes. Yeah.
Admiration is absolutely mutual.
We had a chance to destabilize democracy together with John Kiriakou. you might recall, Brian Becker, we were called out by, I don't remember what CDDC think tank it was. I think it might have been CSIS. Yeah.
Yeah. The laughable part of this is progressives and leftists have been purged from, as I said, from all the national networks and national network cable shows. We've been purged from all of the mainstream media. But if you try to get a media show somewhere else and somebody says, yeah, you can have a show, even if you have complete editorial content, they'll say, how dare you? How dare you? Like, the only way you can really acquit yourself is to remain silent,
yep,
which of course is the thing that we won't do.
Exactly. Just don't be a leftist and be silent. That's what they want. So never.
You all on March 18th.
Yes.
All right. We'll see you around.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching the Unauthorized Disclosure Weekly podcast. Please consider becoming a subscriber of our show. Go to thedissenter.org, sign up for $4 a month, and get early access to all our full episodes, as well as exclusive episodes that we post. We're in our 10th season, and we depend on people like you to keep producing conversations and interviews like this one.